Hi, I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! For more than 15 years, CJSF 90.1 FM has been bringing Democracy Now! To the greater Vancouver area every weekday at 11 a.m. From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The sad reality of what's happening in Gaza right now actually eclipses, I would argue, any sort of even comparative humanitarian crisis that we've seen.
As Israel's assault on Gaza stretches into its seventh month, we'll be joined by Arwa Damon. She's just returned from a humanitarian trip to Gaza yesterday. An award-winning journalist, now the founder of Inara, a nonprofit providing medical and mental health care to children. Then Rwanda marks the 30th anniversary of the 1994 genocide. We'll speak with a survivor.
It's not easy for people who went through genocide to be that strong, but we're there, we're doing our best to make sure that the past never repeats itself.
As up to 1 million Rwandans were killed, the United States, France, and other nations stood by, refusing to stop the slaughter. We'll speak with former Human Rights Watch Executive Director Ken Roth about the role of Western nations in failing to stop the Rwandan genocide and their role in Israel's assault on Gaza, which the UN's top court says is a plausible case of genocide. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Palestinian media say airstrikes hit two homes in Gaza City's Zeitoun neighborhood earlier today, killing and injuring dozens of people. Other attacks were reported in other Gaza City neighborhoods, including Shujaya and Sabra. This comes as negotiations in Egypt continue. Hamas says the latest ceasefire proposal does not meet its demands, but that it's continuing to review the plan, which includes a six-week pause in fighting and the exchange of 40 Israeli hostages for at least 700 Palestinians imprisoned by Israel. While Hamas is demanding Israel end its assault on Gaza, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu warned on Monday that Israel has set a date to invade Rafah.
Today, I received a report on the talks in Cairo. We are constantly working to achieve our goals. First and foremost, the release of all of our hostages and achieving a complete victory over Hamas. The victory requires entry into Rafah and the elimination of the terrorist battalions there. It will happen. There is a date.
Displaced Palestinians have been returning to Khan Yunis after Israel withdrew from the decimated southern city. One woman, Ayed al-Najjar, said normally she would be preparing for Eid celebrations at this time of year as she took in the ruins of her home.
Our house was good and had everything. I lacked nothing. I lived happily with my husband, and our daughter's children used to live with us too. There's no Eid for me. I have no desire to celebrate or do anything. I'll just sit in front of my house like this. We won't go anywhere. And many of our family members were martyred. They're still uncovering the bodies. Praise God. Who wants to celebrate? Every house has wounded or martyrs.
The UN Security Council will make a formal decision on Palestine's bid for full UN membership this month. Palestine initially submitted its application for UN admission in 2011. This is the Palestinian UN ambassador, Riyad Mansour, speaking Monday.
It was a historic moment then, and now that historic moment has been revived again, and we sincerely hope after 12 years since we changed our status to an observer state that the Security Council will elevate itself to implementing the global consensus on the two-state solution by admitting the state of Palestine for full membership.
But the U.S., one of five permanent members of the U.N. Security Council, is expected to use its veto power. U.S. representatives say Palestine needs to negotiate statehood with Israel before it's granted statehood at the U.N. Meanwhile, in The Hague, the International Court of Justice is holding its second day of hearings into Nicaragua's case against Germany. Germany's denied Nicaragua's charge that it violated the Genocide Convention by providing military and financial aid to Israel. Here in the U.S., Massachusetts Senator Elizabeth Warren says she believes Israel's assault on Gaza meets the legal definition of genocide. Warren made the remark as she visited a mosque and was asked by constituents if she believed Israel is committing genocide. Warren said, quote, "If you want to do it as an application of law, I believe that they'll find that it is genocide, and they have ample evidence to do so," she said. Ireland's incoming Prime Minister, Simon Harris, has called for an immediate ceasefire, saying in a speech Sunday, the famine in Gaza is a, quote, specter no Irish person can bear, referencing Ireland's historical famines, including the Great Famine of the mid-19th century. Harris, who's being sworn in by Ireland's parliament today, had a message for Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
Prime Minister Netanyahu, let me say this to you this evening. The Irish people could not be clearer. We are repulsed by your actions. Cease fire now and let the aid flow safely.
Iran's foreign minister opened a new diplomatic site in the Syrian capital, Damascus, Monday, 1 week after Israel bombed the Iranian consulate, killing at least seven Iranian officers. Hossein Amirab Gulahian renewed Iran's vow to retaliate and accused the U.S. of giving Israel the green light for the attack.
I want to say from here in Damascus with a loud voice, America is responsible for this terrorist attack, and it must take responsibility.
Meanwhile, Iranian press is reporting Tehran told the Biden administration it'll refrain from attacking Israel if the U.S. can secure a ceasefire in Gaza. The report has not been confirmed by Tehran, and Biden administration has denied it. The University of Michigan's come under fire over its proposed disruptive activity policy, which was issued by the university president, Santa Ono, after Palestinian rights activists interrupted a speech he was giving. The ACLU of Michigan warns the policy will have a chilling effect and likely lead to violations of the First Amendment. Elsewhere, Vanderbilt University in Tennessee has expelled, suspended, and issued disciplinary probations to a group of students who engaged in a sit-in protest demanding Vanderbilt divest from companies complicit in Israel's occupation and killing of Palestinians. Special Counsel Jack Smith is urging the Supreme Court to dismiss Donald Trump's bid for immunity in his federal election interference case, arguing presidents are subject to criminal law. Supreme Court justices are scheduled to hear arguments in the case April 25th. In other Trump news, the GOP frontrunner said Monday abortion rights should be decided by states. Trump has refrained from endorsing a national abortion ban, but has taken credit for the Supreme Court's overturning of Roe v. Wade, which has led to a cascade of abortion bans in Republican-run states, including Florida, where a six-week ban is set to go into effect May 1st. The trial for 27 people charged in connection with the Panama Papers scandal began Monday in Panama City, 8 years after the massive data leak. In 2016, an international team of journalists published millions of documents exposing how the Panama-based Mossack Fonseca law firm set up a global network of shell companies for some of the wealthiest people in the world, heads of state and other elites, to hide money offshore, avoiding taxes and oversight. The leak prompted the resignation of Iceland's prime minister and implicated other world leaders, including former British Prime Minister David Cameron and Russian President Vladimir Putin. Those currently on trial include the founders of the now-defunct Mossack Fonseca law firm. The Panama Papers represent just a fraction of the trillions of dollars hidden away, often illegally, in offshore tax havens. About 100 people were killed, including children, after an overcrowded makeshift ferry sank off the northern coast of Mozambique. Some 20 others are missing. The group of 130 people had fled from Nampula on mainland Mozambique, reportedly after hearing news of a cholera outbreak. Mozambican authorities blamed their deaths on the spread of misinformation about the spread of the disease. President Biden announced new plans to cancel student debt for about 23 million people. Some of those to benefit include borrowers who now owe more than their original loan amount due to out-of-control interest. Those who have had debts for over 20 years, borrowers who were enrolled in so-called low-value school programs, and those facing economic hardship. The new plan would completely erase student debt for around 4 million borrowers. Biden announced the debt relief in a speech in Madison, Wisconsin, Monday, as he made another pitch for re-election in the key swing state.
I also want to make, and I've been pushing this, and if I'm re-elected, I'm going to push it hard. We're going to get it done next time, is I want to make community college tuition free. So you won't need loans at all. You're cutting half the cost of going to college.
In Strasbourg, France, the European Court of Human Rights handed out one victory and two defeats for the climate justice movement today as it ruled on three historic climate cases. The court ruled in favor of over 2,000 senior women from Switzerland who argued their rights were violated by governmental inaction on the climate crisis.
The court finds that there were some critical lacunae in the Swiss authorities' process of putting in place the relevant domestic regulatory framework. This included a failure to quantify, through a carbon budget or otherwise, national greenhouse gas emissions limitations. Furthermore, as recognized by the relevant authorities, the respondent state had previously failed to meet its past greenhouse gas emission reduction targets. By failing to act in good time and in an appropriate and consistent manner.
The Swiss women hailed their historic victory, but the celebration was tempered by the court's dismissal of similar cases by six youth activists in Portugal and a former French mayor. Activist Greta Thunberg, who was at the courthouse for the verdicts, weighed in on those verdicts.
It's a betrayal beyond words, and today's rulings make very clear that the European states have a legal responsibility to take real climate action and to protect people and to protect its citizens. It cannot be a political choice whether to respect human rights or not.
And the Brazilian state issued a historic apology for the atrocities committed against indigenous peoples during its military dictatorship. The unprecedented move came as Brazil marked last week the 60th anniversary of the 1964 U.S.-backed coup that ushered in the military dictatorship, which ruled for the next two decades. Brazil's National Truth Commission found 8,300 indigenous people were killed during the dictatorship. Others were thrown off their land, imprisoned in internment camps, and tortured. The apology came after the Guarani, Kiowa, and the Krenak indigenous groups requested a collective apology from the Brazilian government's Amnesty Commission. During a ceremony last Tuesday, the commission's chairwoman, Neia de Stutz, kneeled in front of indigenous leaders to ask for their forgiveness. Here she addresses Janira Krenak.
I'm asking for forgiveness for the persecution that in the last 524 years, your people, as well as all the other original peoples, suffered due to the invasion that the non-indigenous people on this land that belongs to you. So you as leader, as the matriarch of the Krenak people, please bear our respect, our tributes, and our sincere apologies so that this never happens again.
Also last week on Friday, prominent journalist, author, and environmentalist Alton Krenak became the first indigenous member of the prestigious Brazilian Academy of Letters. Krenak vowed to use his seat to open the elite academy to the more than 200 indigenous languages in Brazil. He also reflected on the government's apology issued days earlier, saying, quote, "Saying sorry afterwards means very little in terms of reparation. What we need is real reparations for Native peoples," he said. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. When we come back, we'll speak with Arwa Damon, who just returned from a humanitarian trip to Gaza. The award-winning journalist is now founder of INARA, the International Network for Aid and Relief Assistance, a nonprofit that provides medical and mental health care to children. Stay with us.
Made of these, who am I to disagree?
are made of this by Eurythmics. Singer Annie Lennox has donated the 1983 handwritten lyrics to be auctioned off to benefit the charity Medical Aid for Palestine. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman in New York, joined by Democracy Now! Co-host Juan Gonzalez in Chicago. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Israeli warplanes bombed areas across northern Gaza today, while ground troops conducted raids as the assault on the territory entered its 7 months. Forensic experts from Gaza's health ministry are still removing bodies from the yard of Shifa Hospital, once the largest medical facility in Gaza, that was burned down and destroyed by Israeli forces. Health officials say the number of dead following Israel's raid on Shifa is still not known, but is in the hundreds. Meanwhile, in the south, Palestinians who tried to return to Khan Yunis, Gaza's second largest city, following the withdrawal of Israeli troops Sunday, say it is now unlivable. An estimated 55% of the buildings in the Khan Yunis area, around 45,000 buildings, have been destroyed or damaged, according to two mapping experts at City University of New York and Oregon State University, who have been using satellite imagery to track destruction. This comes as Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has escalated his pledge to invade Rafah, where more than 1.4 million Palestinians, well over half of Gaza's population, are sheltering. In a video statement Monday, Netanyahu said, quote, "It'll happen. There's a date," he said, without elaborating. He spoke as Israeli negotiators were in Cairo discussing international efforts to broker a ceasefire deal with Hamas. The official death toll has now topped 33,300, including over 14,000 children. That number does not include thousands missing under the rubble and presumed dead. Nearly 76,000 people have been wounded. Israel has been accused of using starvation as a weapon of war in Gaza, where the spread of hunger and malnutrition has been described as unprecedented, with famine setting in. For more, we're joined by Arwa Damon. She just returned yesterday from a humanitarian trip to Gaza. She's an award-winning journalist and the founder of INARA, the International Network for Aid, Relief, and Assistance, a nonprofit currently providing medical and mental health care to children in Gaza. Arwa Damon is also a non-resident senior fellow at the Atlantic Council. She's previously spent 18 years at CNN, including as a senior international correspondent. Arwa Damon joins us now from Istanbul, Turkey. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Arwa. Can you start off by talking about what you saw in Gaza and what you think needs to be done?
You know, on the one hand, that would seem like a simple question. And yet, on the other hand, it's so extraordinarily difficult to actually put what I witnessed into words. In fact, Gazans themselves can't actually grasp the fact that this has become their reality. In Rafah, in this central southern area of Gaza, where you have a crush of about 1.5 million people, it feels as if you're moving through a sea of misery. There is no empty space left. Tents are spilling out of both UN shelters and other makeshift shelters that have emerged. They're spilling out onto the sidewalks. There's stalls that have been set up. The movement of people clogs the streets. You have people having to move around on donkey carts because there's not enough fuel or diesel to power vehicles. And then you just have the sheer need of this entire mass of humanity that is, to a certain degree, feels as if it's absolutely suffocating because they need everything. They are reliant on others for just about everything, from food to water to medicine to baby formula to diapers. We stepped out in this one area called Mawasi, which is sort of a beachy area. It was Gaza's beachfront. And there, it's just tent after tent after tent in the sand. There's no sewage systems, and so sewage is sort of running along these makeshift canals. There's no proper toilets. There's no nothing. And all of the mothers there are just shoving these emaciated babies at you, you know, begging for proper formula, begging for proper care, They're begging for medicine for children who are epileptic. You walk into a tent, and with each step your foot takes, a cloud of mosquitoes and flies just swarms up. I mean, it's inexplicable.
And Arwa, Israel has in recent days said that it's opening up new entry points into Gaza for aid. Could you talk about the aid that you saw coming in, which still has not reached the level, the number of trucks per day before the war even started?
Right. And there's a number of things that I think, you know, everyone would be best served to understand about, you know, aid and distribution. So, yes, if more aid is able to get in, absolutely, that is going to help. However, when it comes to getting aid to those who need it, it is beyond just opening up additional crossings. The aid trucks that come into Gaza all get searched by Israel, and that is a process that can take around 2 to 3 weeks to begin with. You do see aid being distributed. The problem is that the quantity of the aid is insufficient. Additionally, it's important to note that once the aid gets inside Gaza, getting it distributed within this, you know, tiny little space, yet at the same time extraordinarily difficult to navigate area, poses great and additional challenges. There's a process that's called deconfliction. This exists in all war zones, whereby which aid organizations wanting to reach a certain area will notify warring parties about their intent and will secure permissions to be able to safely move to that area. This is a process that has not and does not work inside Gaza. And the tragic, horrific strike that we saw on the World Central Kitchen convoy is clear evidence of that. And that really sent huge shockwaves within the humanitarian community, because the World Central Kitchen has some of the best deconfliction mechanisms, has some of the best lines of communication to the Israeli side. And so you have these additional layers upon layers of challenges. Add to all of it, the lack of aid has created a very understandable level of panic among the population. What that means is that whenever aid arrives to a certain area, there is chaos and there is panic. And this is why you keep hearing people speaking about the need to flood the zone. The zone needs to be flooded not only with aid so that people can stop panicking and have a certain measure of confidence that they will be getting a stable supply of food, water, and other basic necessities, but also the zone needs to be flooded with humanitarian workers, people who know how to address this level of a humanitarian crisis.
And could you talk as well about the impact of this war, the mental health impact, especially on the children of Gaza that you have spoken so eloquently about in recent days?
I'll give you one example. A mother came up to me and she was she'd heard about the fact that, you know, we do work with mental health, specifically with children. It's also important to note that, you know, when an area population is still in crisis, is still in an emergency, all you can really provide is basic mental health, especially for children. What does that actually look like? It really just looks like a distraction. So creating activities and ways for them to express themselves that can sort of help them distract themselves from all of the horror and the nightmare that they're going through. But this mother comes up to me and she says, I don't know what to do with my 7-year-old right now, because every single night he screams at the top of his lungs and he goes into what look like convulsion and seizures. And he started doing this after he saw his sister's head blown off during a strike that hit their home that also wounded other siblings. You know, you walk around Gaza, and I'm talking specifically about the children right now, but you see this also very deeply in the adults. And you know that sparkle that's normally supposed to exist in a child's eye, it's not there anymore. That's not to say it can't come back and it can't be brought back with these activities. You know, there are these beautiful, heartwarming moments where you are able to create a scenario for a child to be able to, you know, laugh and smile, albeit briefly. But you really feel as if you are walking through a population that is, they're ghosts, and they describe themselves as ghosts. They're ghosts of their past. They're the ghosts of who they used to be, and they're constantly haunted by the ghosts of everything that they have lost. And the trauma doesn't end. It comes at them from multiple different directions every single day. The mental health impact of this is unlike anything that I personally have ever seen 20 years working in war zones. Just the immediacy of the need, the speed with which this all happened. And even people in Gaza, when you talk to them right now, you know, despite having lived through this for 6-7 months, they still tell you that they feel as if, you know, this can't be real, right? Like this can't have happened. This has to be a nightmare from which one day they're going to wake up.
Arwa, you've said, you've pointed out that what's happening in Gaza right now is absolutely egregious, that the Western world, the ones providing the weapons, cannot pressure Israel into allowing more aid and medical staff. Can you talk more about that? I mean, this isn't a natural disaster where, you know, an earthquake happened and people can't get to the people. Explain exactly Israel's role in preventing this aid from getting to those in need.
So nothing goes in and out of Gaza without Israel's approval. Nothing. That includes aid and that includes people. There's a whole process for that. And this is a process that actually existed before October 7th. It is, since October 7th, extraordinarily and excruciatingly long. In addition to that, since 2008, there has been a list of items that are banned entry to Gaza. This list also exists to the West Bank. Now, since October 7th, there have been additional items that are not part of this list that have been rejected. There is no formality to this rejection. We in the humanitarian space end up finding out about items being repeatedly rejected, and as such, there's no point of trying to send them in because of repeat rejections. These items range from things like, you know, solar panels to wheelchairs to certain kinds of medicine to sleeping bags in some cases, anything that the Israelis say can be deemed to be dual use. But the problem is that it feels very illogical. And again, there's no formality to it. So you don't know if an item is going to get rejected until you actually try to send it in. Some organizations have even had children's toys be rejected. You know, you try to put together these hygiene kits for families, and the nail clippers in them get rejected. And as such, the entire truck gets completely turned around. And so it's extraordinarily difficult to try to navigate that kind of a situation. And obviously, this creates an even greater and more desperate need inside Gaza itself. Now, what is very difficult to comprehend, as you were saying there, is the fact that Israel is an ally to the United States and other very powerful Western nations. Is this the first time that we've seen an area under siege? Absolutely not. Look, I covered Syria very extensively. The regime of Bashar al-Assad, a dictatorship, along with their Russian allies, did, yes, put entire neighborhoods and areas in Syria under siege. But there we were talking about a dictatorship with Russia as its ally. We saw ISIS besiege entire areas in both Syria and Iraq, but we're talking about ISIS. We're not talking about a democratically elected nation state that is an ally of the United States. And that is what makes it so difficult for anyone inside Gaza to comprehend how it is that the United States is allowing Israel to continue to besiege the Strip in such a way. And remember, it was on day one that Israel cut off electricity, water, and basically vowed to cut off, you know, any form of assistance. They cannot comprehend this. They cannot comprehend how it is that this is being allowed to happen to them. On top of that, happening to them, and the United States is still continuing to fund the war effort.